This is Barbara Peters, and I am sitting here in an outdoor patio by a fire pit at a beautiful Scottsdale restaurant with one of my very favorite people, Nick Petrie. And we have been talking about a variety of things this evening because he's here to talk to us about his fourth Peter Ash book, Tear It Down. One of the things we've talked about is that that Nick really enjoys coming to Scottsdale or talking to other writers, or in fact going anywhere talking to other writers. So tell me, Nick, what is it that lots of writers just like to stay home and sit in their rooms and not go out. What makes you different?
Well, I think for me, what I like is to be able to kind of talk shop, and when you're a writer, it's really hard to, there aren't very many people who do what we do, right? So to be able to talk through whether it's technical problems or whether it's just sort of what the life is like, or the business of being a writer, of being a publisher, of being in publishing, it's a strange business, and there aren't very many people who have the experience to have that conversation. So especially if you're somebody like me, I'm four books in. What are other people's experience? And we all, writers all kind of, especially crime writers, all kind of share the same sort of disease, right? We all want to tell stories. We all...
Pause a moment. There appears to be a police helicopter overhead.
I didn't do it.
No, you didn't. Isn't that funny? Here we are sitting out here thinking we'd be quiet, and there it goes. I love it. Do you know in Phoenix that you are being rescued from your own folly, like climbing Camelback Mountain? The helicopter will come for you, but you now have to pay for it.
How much does that cost to be rescued?
A lot.
I'm sure.
Right. All right. So back on topic. Sorry.
Well, it's hard to it's hard to find other people who are are sort of living in the same sort of professional world, and it's such a relief when you spend most of your day staring at your computer screen or staring at your notebook or whatever it is that however it is that you work, to talk to somebody who has wrestled with the same problems that you have. And whenever I come to Scottsdale, to the Poison Pen, or I go to Voucher Con, or I go to Thriller Fest, and I get to just sort of kind of go wild with my little tribe, whenever I get back home, I'm energized and refreshed, and I'm ready to kind of all fired up to get going again. So I love to, this is like the antidote to being a writer, is to get out and to see other writers.
Very interesting point. So when you were a carpenter, did you hang out with other carpenters and talk about building houses or whatever carpenter work you were doing?
I did. I was a carpenter, and then I was a contractor. So I had a network of other people in the building trades, and some of them were like plumbing contractors or they were other remodelers like me. But it also wasn't a group that I ever really fit with, because I had this secret, right? I was also writing books, writing stories, and not telling anybody about it.
How many years was that?
25 years.
That's amazing.
With making a fairly minimal progress. And that's not true. Every book that didn't get published, I got a little farther down the food chain. My first unpublished book, I never found an agent, but I got one really discouraging note from an agent who said, "Stop writing, this is terrible." But I also got a couple of really encouraging notes from agents who said, "I'd like to see something else." And the second book, I found an agent who was not a good agent, who it turns out was someone that people had been warned about, but I, of course, was not in the loop and didn't get the recipe, or didn't get the memo about that. And so she didn't get anywhere. And the third book I couldn't get published, I found a great agent, who's the agent I have now, but it was happening right when the crash was happening, and publishers weren't buying anything, and so that book never went anywhere. And it took me that fourth book, where I had a great agent, and the economy had changed, and they were looking for something that was similar to what I had written, and lo and behold. So
that was The Drifter?
That was The Drifter. Was the was the first thing that showed
up. What was it about the PTSD that drew you in so? Since you're not an armed service person and you don't have PTSD, why was that such a driver for you in fleshing out Peter Ash?
The initial thing wasn't post-traumatic stress so much as it was the lives of people coming home from war. And I had met in my life as a building inspector, which is what I did after I was a contractor. I had all these clients who were coming home from war, and I was interested in politics. I'd followed the course of the war, and I realized, kind of to my shame, that I had not given very much thought to the lives of the men and women we'd asked to fight that war. And I met more and more of them, and we kept having these conversations, and I've never been through anything remotely like that, and I couldn't. I can barely talk about it. I was really moved by the idea of how you would come back to your so-called regular life after having been through such a transformative experience. And the post-traumatic stress really came up as a way to sort of give a tangible kind of name and a syndrome or whatever you want to call it to that divide, that difference between people who have never been to war and people who have come home after having been in combat, especially for multiple deployments. And in my main character, Peter Ash, it shows up as post-traumatic, or as claustrophobia, where he can't go inside. And that's, you know, he's really outside of society. He's had this experience which he's proud of and has formed him and has changed him. But it's really hard for almost anybody else to understand that. And that was kind of the thing that really got me going.
He was that dynamic was not present in your unpublished books. It was, did it appear in The Drifter for the first time?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So it really was an emotional springboard for you to be able to do this. When you go out, I noticed, because we've done this together several times, you do talk about this. So is part of the reason that you like to go out and, you know, talk about your books and all, that you also have an opportunity to discuss what it would be like, you know, this, not what it would be like so much, but how it's affected you.
I do, and it's a chance to talk about this with people who really haven't thought about it. And I think a lot of Americans are like me. They haven't brushed up against that experience. And I've had the great privilege of talking to so many men and women who have been to war, and I feel like I have gotten a glimpse of what that experience is like, and a glimpse of how that changes you. And I feel like I'm sort of a missionary from that world into the civilian world, because our military now, we have this all-volunteer military, and you know, the divide between the people who sign up to go fight for us and the people who stay home and go shopping, it is wider than it's ever been before, and it's only getting wider. And so to help that conversation and to help people understand a little bit more maybe what folks who have been to war are going through, and that there's a little more that you might do than just say thanks for your service and give them a wave and you know, go to the grocery store, but to maybe a little more understanding of what that's like.
So Peter's a character that you've shaped in a way that he can go anywhere and do a variety of things. You know, I'm having a blank moment here because I'm thinking about Reacher, who has his army pension, so to speak.
Right.
So even
right.
though he's just got like a toothbrush and, you know, drops in at Target to buy a clean shirt or whatever he does, what financial underpinning does Peter have that makes his life possible?
Well, Peter started out with his back pay. Peter is like any good Wisconsinite, is a frugal soul. But in The Drifter, he and a guy he meets, a career criminal named Lewis, sort of get together and accidentally make a big pile of money. And Peter doesn't really want anything to do with it. He is, in order to enlist Lewis's help, he's basically said, look, you can have it all. I don't want it. I don't care about it. But because of the way things ended in that book, Lewis feels a real debt of gratitude to Peter. And so Lewis has kind of made Peter a partner in his investments. And Lewis is sort of a savant. And they ended up, they began with a substantial amount of money, and now it's grown quite a bit. And I don't actually know, even as the author, how much money that is. I just know that it's more than Peter will ever need. And he really doesn't ask for any, because, you know, he's happy to live on peanut butter sandwiches as long as there's good coffee and good beer and maybe a slice of pizza and a little Mexican food. He's happy. And he can fix his own truck, and he really doesn't have a house. So, you know, he's a simple guy.
He's a minimalist.
He's
definitely a minimalist. But, you know, that's such a useful thing to be able to do with a character, that you want to be free to move around and take on things and investigate, because, you know, if you've removed the tiresome need to make a living, or at least, you know, buy coffee and pizza odd toothbrush and occasional shirt, you know, then that solves a lot of problems. I have a character named Sam Blackman in a series I write, or I edit, for Mark DeCastrique, and he is a war veteran. He's lost a leg, so he has a, you know, prosthetic device. And in his first encounter, he too comes upon an extraordinary amount of money. And he then partners up with a woman, an African-American woman, who's also a veteran, and they form an agency, and, you know, they do interesting things in Asheville, North Carolina. But they are free to do, like, pro bono work or take on whatever interests them, because they've got this money behind them.
Right.
And, I mean, it's an incredibly useful thing in writing crime fiction to free up your character.
Well, it's a little bit of a crutch, because if you have a character who's forced to, you know, go, you know, dig ditches or go work in an office or do something else, it makes it harder for them to have the next adventure.
Well, it does. It's the same problem if you give them a baby or whatever.
That's right.
You know,
that's
you can't, or sometimes even a dog,
It definitely changes the direction of the story.
Well, it means that you have to attend to something that, you know, whether it's in the background or not, that takes away some time and some freedom.
Right.
And, I mean, I think the way that you're envisioning Peter, he doesn't want to be confined. And, you know, June understands that he has that. So he's able to move around the country, and you can explore different cities. For example, Memphis here, maybe eventually Detroit. But, I mean, you know, you could go anywhere.
Sure, L.A.
Yeah, and that really makes it fun for you, you know. But even, is he ever going to come to Milwaukee, your own hometown?
Well, the first book is set in Milwaukee, and my Milwaukee fans are quite vocal, I have to say, about my setting another book back in Milwaukee. So I certainly, there will be one. I'm not sure if it will be the book after the one I'm working on now, or maybe the book after that. I can't really think very far ahead. I'm really kind of up to my eyeballs in the book I'm working on.
I think, are you the only Bard of Milwaukee writing crime fiction at the moment?
There are others, but there are actually a lot more literary writers in Milwaukee. So it's not like there are other people making claims on the territory in the crime world. But I'm a big fan of setting and place, and I think that one of the great benefits of moving a character from place to place is that you get to tell the right story for a particular place.
Right.
And I haven't quite found the next right Milwaukee story yet.
Tina, you know, this is a horrible confession. I'd totally forgotten that your first book, The Drifter, was in Milwaukee.
Well, sure. Well,
so maybe Milwaukee wasn't as powerful a character in The Drifter.
Maybe not.
I'm thinking about the porch and the dog and, you know, all of that.
Right.
But I honestly, till you just said that, had completely forgotten it was in Milwaukee.
Well, it was a few years ago, so it would be understandable if you forgot.
I'm not entirely sure that it's the time lapse so much as maybe it wasn't as powerful. The Redwood setting in your second book, In Burning Bright, I'll never forget. And then clearly you could only have written your third book, you know, in the wide open spaces that you set it.
Right.
This book is all about Memphis. But I'm not sure that The Drifter, Milwaukee, was as critical to it. Or maybe it was, and I'm just having a senior moment.
Well, no, I don't know. You might be right. Although it was my Milwaukee, because I was living. So that's a book that connects veterans coming home from war and the financial crash, and also the housing crisis are kind of all happening at once in that book. And that was the Milwaukee that I was living in, because I was writing it after the financial crash, and I was really pissed. And I was working as a freelance building inspector, so I was seeing homes foreclosed on and stuff piled up along the curbs where the sheriffs had come and put people out of their houses after the banks had kicked them out.
But was it uniquely Milwaukee?
I don't know.
See, that's my point.
I think you're right. It felt like that to me because that was my version of Milwaukee.
Right.
But I don't think that's the version of Milwaukee.
Well, it seemed to me it was more a universal,
Maybe.
I mean, there were lots of places where that could be going on. And I guess maybe that's the reason I failed to register. It was Milwaukee, for example. But you couldn't really have had, Burning Bright any place but in the Redwoods.
Where it was, right.
So, and this book probably had to be in Memphis, although I find it wonderfully ironic that you went to Memphis in order to write an earthquake book, and then instead you drove a truck into a house, and if you'd had an earthquake, the house would have fallen down, your title would have been gone, and it wouldn't have worked out. So, there's a lot of interesting accidents that happen in a writer's life, aren't there?
Well, there are, and I think, to me, that's where all the interesting things happen. I sometimes really wish I was an outliner, and I've tried to write books that way, kind of from a plan, but the happy accidents don't seem to happen. Whereas when I just sort of start at the beginning and write a book as if I'm telling myself a story, that's when strange stuff happens. These crazy characters show up who I don't really know quite where they came from, but suddenly it's like I'm hearing a voice in my head. I'm going to sound like I'm crazy, but...
No, I think you have a very rich subconscious, and it would be a mistake.
That's very generous of you.
No, I meant it wasn't generous at all. I think, people are creative in different ways.
Yeah.
And I think you're a person who has, as I say, a very rich and very active subconscious, and you're smart enough not to try to control it, but to rather let it pilot you along. Everybody's different. And I think that you're smart to have recognized that's how your creativity works.
Well, I think I'm still trying to recognize that in a way. I'm still trying to find the kind of the process that is really mine. And I think it evolves over time. And I think that's part of the joy and the challenge of doing what we do as writers, is to keep inventing the next new thing. Without repeating what you've done before, but still maybe playing with the things that interest you, right? Trying to play with some of the same themes, especially
right.
when you're writing a series, there are often the same themes kind of weaving through. If you read, if you read Michael Connelly, if you read Dennis Lehane, if you read Lawrence Bloch's Matthew Scudder book, Sarah Paretsky,
right.
Yeah, you have a lot of those same themes kind of boiling through.
But as we've said earlier this evening, every book has its own set of problems and doesn't necessarily translate to any other book.
That's right.
So I think what it really comes down to is you have to have confidence that whatever your process is, it will eventually result in a book.
It really is all about confidence. I read something about writer's block where the thesis of the writer was that there really is no such thing as writer's block. It really is a loss of confidence. That you can spin this web, that you can begin at the beginning and at the end you will have something that you can then revise into something. I absolutely agree with you that it really is about confidence.
I think it is. And, I also remember Michael Connelly who said with a laugh, just like I'm doing, that if you're a reporter, there's no such thing as writer's block.
That's right.
It doesn't work to your editor, said, to go ahead and say, well, I'd really cover the fire, but today I have writer's block,
yes,
so forget
yes.
it. This has been fun. Thank you so much for talking to me, and I'm really looking forward to seeing you next year with the fifth Peter, or whenever it comes out, the fifth Peter Ashford.
Thank you very much. It's been great talking with you, Barbara.